Hello again, and welcome back to The Economist magazine on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm volunteer reader Steve Veach. Thanks for tuning in. During the next hour, you'll hear articles from the August 9th to August 15th edition of the magazine. On the cover this week, a photograph of destruction in Gaza. The headline, Why Israel Must Hold Itself to Account. The cover leader, War in Gaza. Why Israel Must Hold Itself to Account, and How It Can Be Made to Do So. That will be followed by four additional Leaders section articles, starting with The New Imperial Preference. Donald Trump's awful trade policy will outlast him. He thinks America is winning. It is not. Then, credit where it's due. Buy now, pay later gets a bad rap, but it could be useful, provided lenders open up. Then, ripe for transformation. McKinsey and its peers need a strategic rethink. AI could make consultancy more effective or redundant. Finally, new ways of looking. Will an astronomical anomaly challenge the idea of scientific revolutions? Not everything is a paradigm shift. Then we'll go to the United States section for inconvenient data. Donald Trump escalates his war on numbers. Another shocking assault on a nonpartisan institution. And then finally to the China section for China's AI juggernaut. 6 months after DeepSeek's breakthrough, China speeds on with AI. Real-world applications have priority over cutting-edge development. So that's our lineup. Let's go back to the top for the cover leader. War in Gaza. Why Israel Must Hold Itself to Account, and How It Can Be Made to Do So. On May 14, 1948, in its Declaration of Independence, Israel embraced universal human rights, quote, irrespective of religion, race, or sex. This belief in individual human dignity is also enshrined in the Geneva Conventions, submitted to governments that same month. Today, the founding vision of Israel and the laws of war are under attack in Gaza. In its bombed and barren landscape, the fate of both lies in the balance. From the beginning, the world has struggled to live up to the high ideals of 1948. Israel was born in violence, and ever since it has wrestled with the tension between upholding universal rights and being the home of a people in a contested land. The Cold War was a standoff between two systems that too often treated humanitarian law as inconvenient. Even so, the decades after the fall of the Soviet Union gave rise to aspirations that law-breaking leaders could be held to account. Gaza shows how this vision is failing. The laws of war are being broken, and the system for upholding them is not working. However, that failure does not exonerate Israel from having to answer for its actions in Gaza, including war crimes and crimes against humanity. Indeed, its foundations as a liberal democracy demand that it must. Something has gone very wrong in Gaza. Israel's just war against terrorists who massacred its people on October 7, 2023, has turned into death and destruction on a biblical scale. Most of Gaza lies in ruins. Millions of civilians are displaced, and tens of thousands have been killed. And still, Israel's prime minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, cannot stop himself. This week it emerged that he wants to occupy all of Gaza. But Hamas is no longer a military threat, so the war no longer has a strategy, and fighting on is no longer just. Worse, Israel's government, despite its duties as an occupying power, has used the distribution of food to civilians as a weapon against Hamas. It continued even when, as predicted, that led to starvation and the death of desperate people queuing for survival rations. by corralling civilians in pockets as it systematically bulldozes their homes, Israel is also practicing ethnic cleansing. Gaza is not alone. Civilians are being slaughtered and driven from their homes in the Democratic Republic of Congo, Myanmar, Sudan, Ukraine, and pretty much every other war zone today. Hamas, don't forget, started the current Gaza conflict 22 months ago with an orgy of hostage-taking and crimes against humanity. Instead of seeking peace, it has gorged on the misery of its own people. It recently described the recognition of a Palestinian state, promised by Britain, Canada, and France, as the, quote, fruits of October 7th. Yet Hamas's crimes do not excuse Israel. The Jewish state is a democracy. It should hold itself to higher standards than terrorists, warlords, and dictators. At the same time, as the laws of war are being broken, the system that enshrines them is failing. The Geneva Conventions sought to spare civilians. However, they were drawn up for wars between states. Most conflicts today involve at least one militia, which makes separating fighters from civilians hard. Under Geneva's code, the high ratio of civilian to military casualties in Gaza is not proof of crimes. Israel has loosened its rules of engagement, but the strip is crowded. Hamas knowingly shelters among civilians. In such circumstances, many civilians die, as America once learned in the Iraqi cities of Mosul and Fallujah. The International Criminal Court is becoming activist, issuing warrants for the arrest of Mr. Netanyahu and his then-defense minister before the Israeli system had time to act. The courts have also become tools in ongoing so-called lawfare. South Africa accused Israel of genocide at the International Court of Justice just 12 weeks after October 7th, allowing activists to bolster their campaigns demanding boycotts of Israel by the West long before a judgment is reached. Activists dream that the courts will impose their notion of virtue on a world that does not share their values. They are doomed to fail. The big powers, including America and China, do not recognize the courts. International law takes a long time to issue final judgments. It has limited powers of enforcement. A case brought today may one day be a deterrent, but it is a poor tool for stopping war crimes as they unfold. That sounds like a council of despair, but it is not. And the reason goes back to 1948. The laws of war were not just a cudgel with which to beat militarists and Nazis. They were also the latest example in a long history of some belligerents imposing restraints on themselves. The question, therefore, is whether Israel, founded as a democratic universalist state, still cleaves to that tradition. In the past, Israel has managed to investigate wars and hold some political and military leaders responsible. It is comparable to other countries at investigating atrocities by soldiers, albeit slowly and with a focus on the lower ranks, as with a lethal strike on the staff from the World Central Kitchen in 2024. However, as we report, higher level accountability is lacking. The Supreme Court and the Attorney General are caught up in a domestic power struggle with Mr. Netanyahu. When it comes to criticizing the government over Gaza, they have been missing in action. It is not too late. The urgent test is whether Israel floods Gaza with food and medicine in order to stop the incipient famine. It should also agree on a ceasefire, which will enable it to recover its hostages. The second, longer-term test will be whether it sets up a truly independent commission of inquiry after the war ends, probably under a new prime minister. The outside world, and especially the United States, have a role in making this happen. No American president in recent times has been less likely to respect international law than Donald Trump. But peace in Gaza would help him stabilize a volatile region and reset relations between Israel and Saudi Arabia. America has repeatedly intervened to stop Israel's wars in the past. This week, roughly 600 former Israeli security officials urged Mr. Trump to act again today. Those officials understand that Israel has an interest in the law, too. Some Israelis calculate that they can do what they like now and patch up relations with the West later. But views of Israel are bleak in Europe and are changing in America among Democrats and the MAGA right. If Israel becomes an ethno-nationalist state that annexes the West Bank and crushes its people, the violence will not cease. You might argue that after suffering the worst attack in its history, Israel will have no appetite for prosecuting its own leaders. However, the penetrating insight which emerges from the Geneva Conventions is that countries which break the laws of war without shame or recourse do not just harm their victims, they also harm themselves. Israel has an existential interest in seeing justice done. If instead it glorifies those who orchestrate famine and ethnic cleansing in Gaza, its politics and society will lurch towards demagoguery and authoritarianism. The young, idealistic country that was born in May 1948 will have been eclipsed. That was the cover leader, War in Gaza, Why Israel Must Hold Itself to Account, and How It Can Be Made to Do So. We'll move on now to leader article number 2, The New Imperial Preference. Donald Trump's awful trade policy will outlast him. He thinks America is winning. It is not. With every passing day, America's new trading order comes into sharper relief. In place of rules, stability, and low tariffs is a system of imperial preference. Duties are not just higher. They are set by presidential whim. Canada and India have irritated Donald Trump, and so they could face tariffs of 35 to 50%. To ward off threats, the EU, Japan, and South Korea have all hurriedly made deals with America. Because Mr. Trump regards deficits, bizarrely, as theft, he has imposed, quote, reciprocal tariffs, ranging from 10% to 41% on tens of other trading partners, which went into effect on August 7th. A seductive idea is settling in that because Mr. Trump is calling the shots, America is winning. The world has not descended into all-out trade war. Only a few countries, including China, have retaliated, while most others have caved, accepting higher duties, opening up their own markets, and promising to invest vast sums in America. Even financial markets seem acquiescent. Although they took a nasty dive after the president unveiled his, quote, Liberation Day levies in April, this time they have taken the duties in their stride. All the while, tariff revenues are rolling in. This thinking is deeply misguided, however. Mr. Trump has started something from which America will lose, not win. Consider first the idea that high tariffs punish not America, but its trading partners. According to the Yale Budget Lab, America's effective tariff rate has risen to 18%, nearly 8 times higher than it was in January, and towards levels last seen in the Depression. The way MAGA paints it, this is a triumph, because America's trading partners are eating higher tariffs, while U.S. Customs rakes in nigh on $30 billion a month. This is a fundamental misunderstanding of trade. When Mr. Trump raises tariffs, he is hurting his own compatriots by depriving them of choice at low prices. Years of experience show that tariffs do not harm the sellers of goods as much as they harm the buyers. Even though foreign suppliers are lowering their prices more steeply than after Mr. Trump's first term duties, analysts at Goldman Sachs reckon that fully four-fifths of the tariffs have so far been borne by American consumers and firms. Just ask Ford or GM. The car makers reckon they paid $800 million and $1.1 billion in tariff costs, respectively, in the second quarter of this year alone. What of the muted market reaction? The S&P 500 remains around 10% higher than it was on Liberation Day. The dollar, though down, has strengthened in recent weeks. But markets are being buoyed by America's extraordinary artificial intelligence boom, which is pushing up expected earnings for its biggest tech firms. Investors may hope, too, that companies will divert their supply chains so as to reduce tariff costs. Details of the trade deals remain fuzzy, and an uncomfortable dynamic may be at play. Markets might expect the president to chicken out as the pain of tariffs becomes clear. But the lack of reaction might be emboldening him to press ahead. America will pay the price. Its long expansion is already under strain. In the first half of 2025, growth underwhelmed and inflation was disappointingly high. Lately, job creation is slowing, and a survey of bosses suggests service sector activity may be close to stalling. But the full toll of tariffs will be felt over the long term. Mr. Trump is discarding a predictable multilateral system that applied the same tariff rate on most products, regardless of their origin, for a bilateral system where rates vary depending on where goods come from, and are subject to ceaseless bargaining. The president will consider exemptions when he is next flattered, and threaten duties when he is next displeased. Whereas once American shoppers were spoilt for choice, as domestic and foreign producers competed to sell to them, now firms that succeed will do so not only because they are the most innovative, but also because they are the cleverest at playing the system. Fortunes will be spent on lobbying. Companies will face needless uncertainty. Shoppers will lose out on innovation and choice. But because the counterfactual world where trade flowed unchecked cannot be observed, voters may not realize what is hurting them. That is one reason why the Trumpian system will be hard to dislodge. If future presidents want to cut tariffs, they will be met by furious lobbying from American firms that got used to sheltering behind them and have thereby become globally uncompetitive. Few consumers will clamor for change if they do not know how much more choice they could have enjoyed. Lawmakers, too, might be reluctant to lower trade barriers if it means giving up tax revenues today for broader prosperity tomorrow. The new system is not just harmful. It could last long after Mr. Trump retires to play more golf. That was Leader Article Number 2, The New Imperial Preference. Donald Trump's awful trade policy will outlast him. He thinks America is winning. It is not. And on we go now to Leader Article Number 3. Credit where it's due. Buy now, pay later gets a bad rap. but it could be useful, provided lenders open up. New forms of credit are often met with suspicion. A century ago, retailers selling furniture and cars realized they could reach more customers if they accepted payments in installments. To detractors, this was a sign of moral decay. "Beware the slimy coils of the installment evil," blared one advert in the Houston Chronicle in 1926. When, in 1958, Bank of America started posting credit cards to customers, it did not take long for opponents to worry about the consequences. Today, the reproachful frowns are aimed at Buy Now, Pay Later, or BNPL. This practice, which lets people pay for things they buy online in installments, is booming. Over $300 billion in payments were financed in such a manner last year. Borrowers tend to be younger and less creditworthy than average, which is fueling concern. Many critics, including Tucker Carlson, a MAGA pundit, fret that the industry preys on the young. Analysts worry that the hidden debt makes it hard to monitor credit risks. Yet, BNPL could be a valuable innovation. New financial products often cause worry because they draw in customers with little experience in credit. Some will undoubtedly be fleeced by charlatans who missell their services. But reaching new customers is generally a good thing. Modern finance is not perfect. The poor and the young are underserved, partly because they often have no credit history. It is only rational for upstarts to fill a gap in the market. If they provide a useful service, they can grow rapidly. After an early spate of fraud, Bank of America's credit card business went on to transform payments. Today, it is better known by the name it took when it was spun out in the 1970s, Visa. For some Americans, credit cards can be a trap. Those with low credit scores are more likely to hold revolving balances, carrying debt over rather than paying it off each month. Their heavy interest bills subsidize those with better credit scores, who amass points and other benefits. BNPL is different. Its providers earn most of their money from merchant fees, not debt interest. BNPL borrowers are no more likely to get into debt difficulties than cardholders. Despite the lower credit scores of typical users, BNPL loans have a default rate of around 2%, similar to the share of credit card payments that were more than 120 days delinquent. BNPL purchases are low value and do not involve revolving balances, which probably helps. Critics are right, though, to worry that BNPL loans remain hidden from regulators and other lenders. Providers do not supply comprehensive data to credit reporting firms on their users' borrowing and repayments. Although they benefit from checking their customers' credit, they deny other lenders the opportunity to do the same. That raises the possibility that banks will lend to people with hefty BNPL debts, not realizing they are riskier than they appear. Some providers say they do not trust credit bureaus to understand this new form of finance. Others may see opacity as an advantage because it attracts borrowers who wish to keep their debts hidden. Despite such concerns, providers should be required to report their data. As Affirm, one of America's largest BNPL lenders, has recently begun to do. Many providers aspire to reach further into mainstream finance. To achieve those dreams, they must open up. That was leader number 3, credit where it's due. Buy now, pay later gets a bad rap, but it could be useful, provided lenders open up. And we'll move on now to leader article number 4. Ripe for transformation. McKinsey and its peers need a strategic rethink. AI could make consultancy more effective or redundant. Since the birth of management consultancy at the turn of the 20th century, people have questioned its usefulness. Bosses of firms that hire consultants are paid lavishly to define a vision and corral their teams into achieving it. Why would they ask a bunch of jet-setting know-it-alls who have never run anything but a spreadsheet calculation how to do their job? Over the decades, however, consultants have proved their worth, and not just because their clients are lazy, incompetent, or scared of making difficult decisions. In 1990, McKinsey, BCG, and Bain, the three elite strategy advisors, had a few thousand staff between them. Today, they employ around 90,000. Over the past decade, their combined revenue has more than doubled, and they do seem to offer useful advice. Recent research finds that companies which hire strategy consultants experience a significant and sustained improvement in productivity relative to those that don't. Now, though, the industry is heading for disruption. If consultants are to stay useful, they need to rethink what they do. The value of consultancies lies chiefly in their experience of similar problems at other clients. Situations a chief executive might encounter only once in a career, such as a big merger or relocating a factory, are rarely unique. Some critics argue that consultants who swan in and out of clients tend to offer elegant but impractical recommendations. But that view is out of date. In recent years, the strategy trio have moved deeper into helping clients implement their advice. For example, by helping them digitize their businesses. And they are increasingly tying their fees to the success of their projects, thereby aligning their interests with those of their clients. For the bright young things these firms hire, the experience seems to pay off. Many of the world's biggest businesses, from Alphabet to Coca-Cola, are run by alumni of the three elite consultancies. And our analysis suggests that these companies outperform their peers. As the age of artificial intelligence, or AI, beckons, however, the corporate world's consigliere face an uncertain future. Plenty of senior partners quietly scoff at the idea that technology will be anything but a blessing for an industry that has mastered the art of jumping on every new management craze. Already, companies struggling to make use of AI have turned to the strategy advisors for help. For their part, the consultancies have built bots trained on their intellectual property that can perform much of the grunt work behind their projects. But what happens when AI models also start producing the kinds of alliterative three-part frameworks those senior partners so proudly present? In recent years, the firm's core business of strategic advice has grown robustly alongside the push into implementation. Soon it may come under strain. Meanwhile, fast-growing technology providers such as Palantir are also helping clients deploy AI systems, which could force the traditional consultants to retreat. To remain relevant, the industry will have to adapt. Generic ideas recycled from client to client will become of little use. To compete with ever smarter AI models, the approach of training up generalist advisors will have to give way to earlier and deeper specialization, including in the art of managing change. That, combined with the need for fewer minions to do a senior partner's bidding, will require the firms to rethink whom they hire and how they nurture them. To a degree, these changes are already underway at the Elite Trio. To help clients implement their ideas, they have hired thousands of specialists such as coders. BCG's success in using these experts is at least part of the reason why it is on track to overtake McKinsey as the largest of the three firms. To succeed in the decades ahead, however, a more extensive overhaul will be needed. As the firms expend time and energy reinventing themselves, they will have to accept that there are some problems, particularly those relating to technology, that others are better placed to help their clients solve. All this will require humility, something that does not come easily to many in the industry. Consultants often speak of the need for transformation. Now they will have to live it. That was Leader Article number 4, Ripe for Transformation. McKinsey and its peers need a strategic rethink. AI could make consultancy more effective or redundant. And this is a good time to pause and remind you that you're listening to The Economist magazine on Sun Sounds of Arizona. This program featuring articles from the August 9th to August 15th edition of the magazine. And we move on now to the fifth and final leader article in this issue, New Ways of Looking. Will an astronomical anomaly challenge the idea of scientific revolutions? Not everything is a paradigm shift. Before the revolution triggered by Nicolaus Copernicus, a 16th century cleric, the Earth was the unmoving center of the cosmos. Afterwards, it was one of a family of planets swinging through space. Before the work of Antoine Lavoisier, an 18th century nobleman, chemists had no notion of oxygen, carbon, and the like. Afterwards, they could not understand the contents of their alembics without them. Such examples are at the heart of the idea, put forward in the 1960s by Thomas Kuhn, of the paradigm shift. Such shifts, he argued, did not just involve a new theory explaining the world better than an old one. They required a change in the sort of entities the world was thought to be made up of. In a way, that seems almost self-exemplifying. The idea provided a new way of looking at science itself, not as one thing, but two. In the, quote, normal phase, scientists applied their physical and conceptual tools to problems the scope of which was pretty well understood. In revolutionary phases, paradigms shifted. Normal didn't mean dull or unimportant. When, in the 1980s, American astronomers made the case for the Hubble Space Telescope, then the costliest scientific instrument in history, none of its goals mattered more than what seemed a perfect example of normal science, nailing down the value of the constant, also named after Edwin Hubble, an astronomer, which says how fast the universe is expanding. The Hubble did this very well. The difficulty, as our science section reports, is that since its launch, it has become possible to estimate the Hubble constant on the basis of background radiation from all over the sky, rather than distances to individual objects. And these new estimates are significantly lower. The seemingly unbridgeable divide between the approaches has become known as the Hubble tension. To those who know their coon, this looks like the sort of anomaly that might precede some new paradigm shift. The possibility is tantalizing. The conceptual usefulness of paradigm shifts has been much debated, as indeed has their existence. The concept is horribly overused. A new paradigm for vegan cosmetics? Yet the notion of a fresh worldview remains dramatic and beguiling. And the romance only increases when it applies on a cosmic, but reassuringly inconsequential, scale. A paradigm shift in financial markets might be far more practically important. The problem is that, as Kuhn noted, you can judge these things only in retrospect. The sort of anomaly that is recast and solved by a paradigm shift is not, in principle, distinguishable from a, quote, normal problem which has not yet been solved. The paradigms in which normal science is done are, like the fabric of the universe, somewhat stretchy. New ideas, sometimes quite big ones, can be incorporated without wholesale change. And some suspect that science's capacity to adapt itself in this way has increased since the days of Kuhn's examples. It is far more institutionalized and regimented today, and that may provide a stability, even a rigidity, to its world views. This need not be a bad thing. Paradigm shifts are not necessary for technological improvement. But it is hard not to think that, if their age has gone, then so has some of science's thrill, and hard not to want the Hubble tension to demonstrate that paradigms can still be pulled apart. That was Leader Article number 5, the final leader in this issue, New Ways of Looking. Will an astronomical anomaly challenge the idea of scientific revolutions? Not everything is a paradigm shift. And we'll move on now to the United States section for inconvenient data. Donald Trump escalates his war on numbers. Another shocking assault on a nonpartisan institution. Just 4 months ago, Donald Trump was basking in the glow of the jobs report produced by the Bureau of Labor Statistics, or BLS. Great job numbers, far better than expected, he posted on Truth Social, his social media site. But on August 1st, the BLS announced that employers had added fewer jobs than expected in July. It also revised down the employment data for the previous 2 months. This time, Mr. Trump turned on the messenger, saying, without evidence, that the figures were, quote, rigged. He fired Erica McIntarfer, the BLS commissioner who was confirmed last year on a bipartisan basis. Mr. Trump has pledged to appoint a successor to Ms. McIntarfer, who is, quote, much more competent and qualified, so that BLS statistics are, quote, fair and accurate and, quote, can't be manipulated for political purposes. But the president's vainglorious sensitivity and norm-busting intervention will make it difficult for any appointee to reestablish trust. Unfortunately, as a result of this, says a BLS worker, the administration is, quote, going to change the perception of anything that comes out. The episode also comes at a time when the cash-strapped bureau is struggling to measure an increasingly sprawling workforce and a public reluctant to respond to government surveys. The numbers produced by the BLS are still some of the most important indicators tracking America's $30 trillion economy. Its headline-generating jobs report, usually released on the first Friday of each month before markets open, is read closely by reporters, investors, and the Federal Reserve. The report is drawn from two surveys. The first asks individuals whether they are working or looking for a job. These results determine the unemployment rate. The second survey collects payroll data from businesses and government agencies to track the total number of paid positions in the economy. Together, the measures offer a snapshot of the economy's momentum. What specifically set Mr. Trump off was the magnitude of technical adjustments known as revisions. The agency releases preliminary estimates based on incomplete data because it is helpful for the Fed and investors to know quickly what is happening to employment. As more data arrive, the BLS updates its estimates, issuing revisions. These are often modest, typically adjusting the figures by some 40,000 jobs, or about 20% on average. But the most recent revisions were three times that. Goldman Sachs, a bank, called it the, quote, largest two-month revision since 1968, outside recessions. Mr. Trump alleges malice, claiming the new numbers were manipulated to make him look bad. For that to be true, it would require a vast conspiracy coordinated by scores of civil servants. The process of producing the jobs report is designed to prevent meddling. It is intentionally decentralized, with strict digital security protocols, physical lockdowns in the BLS headquarters during the week preceding public release, and siloed workflows. If protocol is followed, the commissioner would not collect or analyze any data herself. It is a puzzle why this month's revisions were unusually large. Historically, revisions have tended to be larger when the economy is at a turning point, precisely when the imputation methods used by the BLS, which lean heavily on historical data patterns, become less reliable predictors of future conditions. Some data sleuths have pointed out that a disproportionate share of the downward revisions came from state and local government payrolls. Declining response rates to government surveys may have played a role, too. A decade ago, response rates were 20 percentage points higher. Fewer respondents means noisier estimates. Some also point to staffing and budget constraints. Across that same period, the BLS budget has fallen by some 12% in real terms, and the White House has proposed cutting it by another 8% this year. The reason could also be more mundane. Random chance. Whatever the explanation, Mr. Trump has undermined confidence in the agency's output. Private sector alternatives cannot replicate what the BLS provides. There is already enormous financial incentive to do so. Trillions of dollars in global assets reprice within moments of a BLS release. If investors could reliably anticipate the results using private sector proxies, they would. But the alternatives that exist, like the jobs report from ADP, an HR firm, are widely regarded as noisy and too narrow. Private sector estimates are also benchmarked to government surveys, which serve as a sort of statistical ground truth. And even if a private firm managed to reliably estimate headline numbers, they would still fall short on providing granular insights across sectors, geographies, and occupations. Decision-making about interest rates and investing is hard enough with BLS numbers that are widely regarded as reliable, within the limits of survey methodology. For a time, at least, those peering at the economy's horizon will have to cope with dimmer light. That was an article from the United States section, Inconvenient Data. Donald Trump escalates his war on numbers. another shocking assault on a nonpartisan institution. And we'll turn now to the China section for China's AI juggernaut. 6 months after DeepSeek's breakthrough, China speeds on with AI. The real-world applications have priority over cutting-edge development. The mecca for China's boom in artificial intelligence is Liangzhou, a leafy suburb of Hangzhou, the tech-heavy capital of Shijiazhuang province. The Communist Party has long touted Liangzhu's famous archaeological remains, dating back to 3300 BC, as proof of the age of Chinese civilization. Now, Liangzhu, with its myriad AI startups, represents the future. Investors from all over China flock there to meet growing numbers of founders, app engineers, and other AI developers and dreamers. It is 6 months since a barely known AI startup, DeepSeek, caused a huge stir by releasing an impressive open-source model trained for a sliver of the cost of fancier Western ones. Its founder studied at Shijiazhuang University, a tech mothership not far from Liangzhu. The area is at the heart of an AI ecosystem which China hopes will soon rival America's. The signs are promising. Last month, three Chinese labs introduced stellar large language models that are reckoned to be among the world's best. AI technologies have, quote, broken through the critical threshold of usefulness, says one early-stage investor who frequents Liangzhu. He predicts a surge in how AI can be applied. Once the water boils, he says, many people want to build a steam engine. Sam Hu, at a sunny cafe in Liangzhu's main plaza, is one such person. After stints at Tencent, a tech giant, and two ride-hailing firms, last year Mr. Hu struck out on his own to develop an AI agent that helps managers make decisions. The moment was right. These days, he explains, quote, the cost of trial and error is lower. The prize for Mr. Hu and his peers is enormous. Morgan Stanley, a bank, predicts that China's AI industry will grow from $3.2 billion last year to $140 billion by 2030. That figure jumps to $1.4 trillion when AI-related sectors such as infrastructure and component suppliers are included. In June last year, some 8% of Greater China firms, surveyed by Gartner, a consultancy, were using generative AI. Less than a year later, the figure had leapt to 43%. The question now is how to keep the industry steaming along. Some of the early frenzy around DeepSeek has passed, and plenty of users still grumble about how models can, quote, hallucinate. But DeepSeek's breakthrough has helped shift China's approach to AI in profound ways. It has lowered costs and moved the emphasis away from cutting-edge development and cutthroat competition among developers of AI models towards explorations of how AI can be applied across business, industry, the public sector, and society itself. The importance of AI for China, and indeed the way it can outdo America, its AI promoters increasingly argue, is through its adoption, adaptation, and diffusion, that is, spreading the use of AI more broadly. It helps greatly that China's leadership believes the same thing and is offering state backing. President Xi Jinping's handshake with DeepSeek's founder, Liang Wenfeng, broadcast earlier this year into the country's living rooms, helped transform how ordinary Chinese view AI. Grandparents were suddenly keen to try out chatbots. The early frenzy was all a bit over the top, says Louis Dong, who developed AI courses for school children after parents bombarded the education company he works for with requests. Now, Mr. Dong says, the focus is on identifying applications for specific industries and putting AI capabilities to pragmatic use. Rapid adoption is key, many experts argue, and DeepSeek's breakthrough, along with advances in other models, is enabling it. Companies appear to be adopting a more can-do attitude by experimenting with the technology. There is still room for improvement. Accenture, a consultancy, found that 46% of Chinese firms have broadly integrated generative AI, but only 9% saw real benefit in productivity or profit growth. It is early days, AI executives insist. Jiang Xinghua, chief technology officer at Yixi Intelligence, which develops AI customer service agents for retailers and AI live streamers for beauty brands, says ever more clients want to adopt AI-enabled products and are even tolerant of them making minor mistakes. The big question is how much AI products can improve. A lot, say the techno-optimists. Chinese efforts to train new models have been complicated by America's ban on exports of its most advanced AI chips. In April, President Donald Trump's administration banned shipments to China of NVIDIA's H20 chip, which is deliberately hobbled to make it less effective for training, though it is well suited to inference, the process of actually running AI models for customers. In July, America reversed course. Yet the political uncertainty and risk remain. Strikingly, China's AI development seems to sail on through the turbulence. At a huge AI conference in Shanghai last month, the boss of a leading Chinese model maker, MiniMax, predicted inference costs would continue to fall, as they have done, by orders of magnitude. Mr. Jiang of Yixi Intelligence says that although Chinese AI development is frustrated by being denied the best foreign models, such as Gemini and GPT, domestic open source models are improving rapidly. So rapidly, indeed, that on August 5th, OpenAI, the developer of GPT, released its first free and customizable models in years to compete with Chinese ones. Meanwhile, the state is playing a big role, not only by supporting AI development, but also in creating demand. In April, when the leadership convened a study on AI, Mr. Xi talked about making the most of China's systematic state-led advantage in mobilizing the whole country. Lower levels of government, used to reading cues from the top and keen to find new areas of economic growth, have embraced the message, often rather keenly. When Rokid, a Hangzhou startup making AI-equipped glasses, submitted an application to the district-level government for a subsidy, 3 million yuan, or $420,000, appeared in its account within 8 minutes. Across China, cities are rushing to offer subsidies for everything from housing to computing power to tailoring open-source models to suit business needs. The state is also an important customer. State museums offer Rokid glasses for tours, while state power workers use them to identify faults along transmission lines. Meanwhile, provincial and municipal governments have rushed to use DeepSeek to improve hotlines, analyze data, and interpret policies for residents. Shen Yang, a professor at Tsinghua University, says he has consulted for twice as many government units across China this year compared with last year. They all want to know how to use AI. One example is Beijing's Haidian district, well known for its tech universities and businesses, which has deployed AI software to help teachers prepare lessons. Another one is Jiangxi Province, which wants to integrate AI into its rare earth and ceramics industries. Plenty of risks come with the state and investors rushing in. Analysts at Jefferies, an American investment bank, identify enthusiasm for humanoid robots as a bubble in the making. Humanoid robots are part of a so-called embodied AI push written into the central government's work report this year. Local governments are falling over themselves to back them. Yet it may be years before the humanoids can be put to profitable use, if they ever can. Other applications of AI might carry greater risks than excess capacity. In April, Tsinghua researchers asked if the more than 300 Chinese hospitals already using DeepSeek were moving, quote, too fast too soon, and were in danger of making diagnoses based on false outputs. Last month, another group of researchers identified, quote, an urgent need to ensure that AI was being safely and responsibly deployed at hospitals. The central leadership is growing more aware of the possible pitfalls. Last month, Mr. Xi named AI, along with computing power and electric vehicles, as areas shown excessive attention by local governments. Do all provinces have to develop industries in these directions, he asked. The answer is surely no. But for now, their involvement is another reason for thinking that China's AI juggernaut will keep rolling. That was an article from the China section, China's AI juggernaut. 6 months after DeepSeek's breakthrough, China speeds on with AI. Real-world applications have priority over cutting-edge development. And that brings us to the end of our time for this program. Over the past hour, you've been listening to articles from the August 9th to August 15th edition of The Economist, the weekly news magazine from Great Britain. I'm Steve Veitch, and it has been my pleasure to read them. Thanks for listening. Tune in next week for another reading of The Economist, and I'll be back with you in 2 weeks. And finally, I remind you that if you missed any part of this program, you can access it on demand. In fact, you can listen to this and most other SunSounds programs at your convenience with On Demand. Just go to sunsounds.org/broadcastinfoandaudio/ On Demand.